We'll call the meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is now 1:05 PM, Friday, January 21st, 2022. Developing a quorum, we have with us Representative Shragi, Representative Gillum, Representative Hannon, Representative Rauscher, Representative Hopkins, Representative Kronk, Representative McKay. Unfortunately, Representative Fields couldn't join us today. I'd like to say thank you to the folks staffing us today with our secretary online, Robin, I believe, and then our new LIO monitor being trained up by Doug is Leo. So welcome, Leo, to the operation here. We're going to be covering House Bill 135, and the folks that are here to help staff that are Ms. Haley Payne, Laura Boomershine, and a few others online. I've got a few others online that'll help handle the back and forth of the questions. First of all, I'd like to remind folks to silence your cell phones, put them up on a notepad so we don't feel the vibration throughout the table. Welcome back, everybody. Hope you had an enjoyable summer, what summer there was. And as always, we have Grace Irvin here, staffing the committee for us. We'll be hopefully communicating clearly as we can on amendment deadlines, hearing schedules, and plans for different bills as we go through this session. I'd like to remind folks of the masking rules set forth is that keep your mask on at all times, even when speaking. Not the same as the floor operation, so make a mental note of that. And just to notice that any hearing requests that you had submitted in regards to a bill that you were running would need to be resubmitted this year so that we can start that process all over again. And I'm looking forward to another productive year with you folks. I think we had 12 bills moved out of committee last session, something like that, 12 or 14, so fairly productive, I suppose. So picking up where we left off is House Bill 135, and it's the geothermal resources by DNR. I think we heard it in the spring of 2021. I don't remember if we did one or two hearings on it, but I think today what we'll do is just a kind of fast-paced overview of, you know, the first couple of presentations so we can familiarize with ourselves with the bill again. The plan is to, if everybody's comfortable, move it out on Monday. If there are reasons for amendments or cause for concern for anything, then we have a Wednesday and Friday scheduling that we can re-bring it up if we need to adopt amendments on Monday or something like that. So, and with that, the amendment deadline will be Sunday, but you know, we'll be willing to work with anybody to try to get that squared away. So make sure I didn't miss any of the housekeeping stuff. So like I said, yeah, we've got Haley Payne with the Division of Oil and Gas, who's kind of the front runner for this bill. And then we've got Steve Masterman and Dave LePayne. So Haley, if you can go ahead and give yourself an introduction, and any members on the records, I think Laura is going to run the slides for us, and we can begin our presentation.
Hello, yes. Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. I'd like to thank you again for providing us this opportunity to bring this bill before you today. We're very excited to be able to run through this. Again, my name is Haley Payne. I am the Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. And with me on the line, we do also have Sean Clifton from the Division, Steve Masterman, and David LePayne, that are both from DGGS. Should there be any questions from the committee, they get into their geothermal resources or some of the technical aspects of it. So with that, go ahead and launch into our presentation. Thank you, Laura, for being in the room for us today. So House Bill 135, we'll just go to slide 2 on our agenda. What we'd like to do here today is to provide that quick overview that you indicated at the beginning. We want to just discuss the purpose of HB 135, provide a brief history of the DNR geothermal leasing history, and then go into the sectional analysis and summary. Part of this review, I will also bring up any questions that the committee had the previous time the bill was read, just to refresh folks' memories on the answers that were provided. And again, if there's anything further necessary from us today, we'll be sure and get that to you. Next slide, please, Laura. We'll go ahead and just go one more slide, to slide four. We are now on the purpose of HB 135. So really what we're hoping to accomplish with this bill is to modernize Alaska's geothermal exploration license program. We believe there are opportunities to develop state resources, and we really see this bill as increasing the feasibility for companies to develop those resources. We see several benefits as a result of that. Obviously, one of the big hopes is to be able to provide affordable, renewable energy, potentially to our rural communities and in remote natural resource extraction projects. We also see this as an opportunity to create more jobs in the growing clean energy sector. Our intention or our reason for being able to do this is we believe that if we align our geothermal licensing program with our existing oil and gas exploration licensing program, we will have a robust system in place that really increases the potential for companies to get out there. Some of the main highlights that I will get to as we go into this sectional analysis, this bill seeks to provide more time for a company to identify and prove resources and therefore convert them to lease. We would like to see this conversion process be based on the completion of a work commitment, rather than having to prove a commercial resource. And we'd also like to double the maximum acreage allowed for exploration. Again, all of this is in line with existing programs and abilities and capabilities of the Division of Oil and Gas and DGGS in terms of running our other programs. One of the final points for this modernization is to make sure that we're considering geothermal resources in line with commercial use and also reflecting the changes in technology that have occurred to make sure that our definitions focus more broadly, not just on temperature, but on capability. So specifically in this bill, we will make sure and explicitly exclude geothermal as domestic, non-commercial, or small-scale industrial use. This is only provided for geothermal on a larger commercial scale. And slide, please, Laura, unless there's a question there.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Payne and Ms. Boomershawn. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Payne, do we currently require domestic, non-commercial, or small-scale industrial use to have some kind of lease or permit from the state, and would that continue? I understand that in HB 135, we want to move the commercial exercise of it to a very specific and modernize that. But for the ones that we aren't, do we already have leasing for non-commercial uses or a permit from the state? And how would those be managed?
Absolutely. Representative Hannah through the chair. So just to provide some clarification, under our current statutes, A small scale or home industrial system does not require a permit or lease, but that's more implicit and not explicit. So we want to go ahead and explicitly state that in terms of this. You'll also see as we move through the slides when we talk about preferential rights, that we're making sure it is clear that those homeowners or individuals would not be impacted. And so by explicitly stating it, it allows for some of these other changes laid in the bill. Does that answer your question?
Follow-up, Representative.
Largely it does, through the chair. So I'm just, because we spend a lot of time, or the underlying premise under our oil and gas leasing is about subsurface rights. And I guess I'm curious whether we have any sense of subsurface use of geothermal that is not commercial in the state, and hadn't thought of it till you're laying it out here, is making sure we're differentiating. And so I'm wondering if we think it's going on, and is it not, do we not, does a property owner currently need a permit to drill up the hot springs that they found on their back 40?
Representative Hannon through the chair. So yeah, just to clarify, again, a homeowner is not going to require a permit from DNR in order to access the sort of geothermal under their own property that would be used, for instance, in terms of a heat pump. I would have to defer to the other members on this call, Director Masterman, specifically if, you know, in terms of the quantity or number or known locations of the duration of use of those sorts of products here in the state.
And my follow, I don't, I, it's not encompassed in this, so I'm fine with a later turnaround on that because it doesn't directly pertain to House Bill 135, but you've now got my wheels turning about subsurface rights of permitting that we monitor so closely for all other property owners in their backyards. So I'm not sure if Representative Rauchers, where all those hot springs are lying that we want to take advantage of, or if it's up in the chairman's backyard, but somewhere someone's got it. They just haven't told us about it.
Yeah, and I won't tell you about my hot springs. Any other questions on the current slide, Representative Hopkins?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Payne. One question on the fifth point down you had. It doubles the maximum acreage allowed for exploration. Looking in the introduction letter, that's a doubling of what an individual can get for a lease. Is that correct? From 50,000 to 100,000 acres?
Yes, through the chair, that is correct. We will be doubling from 50,000 to 100,000 acres.
Thank you. And follow-up. Have we heard that that was a problem or a concern for any of the current lessees or people trying to get leases for geothermal production?
And through the chair, we haven't found that to be a problem per se, but any time you can increase the acreage, you're going to be able to maximize the potential. As Director Masterman would be able to articulate, sometimes there is a challenge in terms of indicating exactly, you know, when you see a hot spring at the surface, for instance, where the actual resource is located for that. It isn't typically directly underneath, or it may not be. And so this kind of expands the field of where they'd be able to search. And also, just for reference, in our exploration licensing program, an individual may seek 500,000 acres. So we do not think that this change from 50 to 100,000 would be anything out of the par with our equal mineral leasing program.
Thank you. It's a lot of land, but that's – oh, sorry, one more follow-up I did have. While the five-year lease is in place to work on trying to prove up the source and get the, complete that work commitment, is that 100,000 acres roped off from any other types of development, any other types of exploration or sales?
Well, thank you for your question here. Through the chair, absolutely not. Our leases are not exclusive, and so we have reserved the right to allow other sorts of development of different sorts of resources, and if there needs to be a surface access for some sort of reason. So these are not sort of mineral closing orders by any stretch. This just certainly allows an individual to enter this area and to begin to explore for those resources. And, of course, all of our access provisions are guided through a plan of exploration and lease plan of operations, and we'd be vetted accordingly through there. But no, the state does not grant an exclusive right to access the property, but it would just be exclusive to the geothermal. That's what they would be earning. But any other mineral or the right to enter the land would not be included in that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Payne. Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So it grants an exclusive right. Is there any risk, however, that someone's granted the right to explore for geothermal and starts to develop those resources and essentially makes that area unviable for other exploration?
Representative Shragi, through the chair, so when we take a look and evaluate specific plans for operations, obviously we would be sure to take in mind the beneficial uses of the region more generally speaking. I think without having a specific plan in front of us in terms of understanding the resource size and how that might further progress into a plant, it would be a bit speculative to say. You know, just using the analogy that we have on the North Slope, if we have an instance where we have an oil and gas facility, there are, you know, certain competing uses that would have to then be taken into account. But I don't think that allowing the opportunity to explore for geothermal would necessarily preclude us from continuing to advance our other resources in the area.
Follow-up, Representative Ferguson.
Thank you, through the chair. So it sounds like there's a process, or is there a process that's outlined for the department for evaluating those kind of different opportunities in that area, or would this just be discretion of the administration?
Yes, absolutely. absolutely, Representative Trotty, through the chair. So we do have multiple processes that we need taken into account. So the first and foremost of that is our best interest finding process. So what would happen is an applicant would come in and ask for a permit on a set area, and then the state would conduct a best interest finding. In that best interest finding, we evaluate all of the potential uses of the area. We describe the environment. We go through and document what could be any potential impacts, cumulative, that may happen to any of those resources or uses as a result of said permit activities being permitted in the area. And then only after balancing the potential positive and negative effects will the director then make a final determination. This is a public process that is noticed publicly, that incorporates comments. And then following that, once a permit would be granted to an individual, once they have specific actions and activities, a plan of development or exploration together, they would then need to go through a permitting process to actually indicate actual activities. So the first phase, the BIF disposal, just allows them to enter the land. And the second phase of public process and notice would be when they have a specific plan where there are specific metrics and sizes that we can take into account and let the public know about, and then provide comment on that.
Thank you. That's fine for now.
Thank you, Representative Shragi. Representative Gillum?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. My concern is not so much another company coming in, but my concern would be, could somebody with a permit lock the area up where there would be no access to Alaska residents who are used to using the land for sustenance? I've seen that happen. And when you said 500,000 acres, that is a lot of land for somebody to come in and landlock, and people are, you know, normally hunted there, and now they can't. So is that going to be an issue?
Representative Gill for the chair. So perhaps to first clarify, the 500,000 acres was in result to our oil and gas exploration licensing program. Through this particular bill, we are seeking to change from 50,000 to approximately 100,000 acres. But to your main point, which is in terms of preventing access for other users to enter the area, no, sir, this bill would not do anything to change folks' ability to access that. Our licensing is simply to the mineral estate. We would not impact or impede folks, especially for any particular uses, subsistence, and all of this is taken into accord. So this bill itself would not change any of that. Under our current geothermal program, we have not encountered any of those issues that you have identified.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Gillum. And Mr. Masterman, if there's anything that you wanted to add or clarify before we move on to the next slide, feel free to.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question?
Thank you, through the chair. This is Steve Masterman, Director of DGGS. And no, I think Ms. Payne handled it very, very cleanly and very clearly. And unless there was some follow-up questions specifically about the geological aspects, I think I don't have anything to add.
Thank you, Mr. Masterman. And Representative Fields, go ahead.
Just a question in terms of area. So there's language in here expanding the area. Should there also be language expanding the potential size of the facility, or is that not necessary? Is the existing size of the facility sufficient?
And Representative Fields to the chair, so that would not necessarily indicate a change in size of the facility. The sizing for the facilities would be based on what the resource requires. And so this merely allows them the ability to look in a greater space to see what resource may be there. You know, you could have a 100,000 acre parcel, but there may only be the benefit resource of something that could generate 10 megawatts. And so the type of facility that would be placed there would be of the size and scale, that makes sense for the resource itself.
Representative Fields.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Payne. Ms. Boomershine, I think we can go to the next slide, barring any other questions.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman. So returning to our presentation, we are now on slide 5. Slide 5 goes into a bit of the geothermal leasing and permitting history that we have had in the state. As you can see, since the program was first initiated in 1983, it has not been a significantly large program. Pretty much all of the exploration thus far or the tracts that have been shown interest are in the Mount Spurt area. What's important to note is that these activities from 1983 to 2013 that are listed were all done through a competitive leasing program. Our competitive leasing program will not be changed or affected by this bill whatsoever. Our competitive leasing program is designed for when multiple parties show an interest and show the need to bid on tracts in a competitive environment. As you're all aware, we like to competitively make our resources available to ensure that we're maximizing our value for the state. This bill seeks to address those times when there is only a single interested party and there is not a competitive process. And so that currently is called a prospecting permit, but it can be better characterized as an exploration license. Presently, we do have two parties that have prospecting permits. Two in the Mount Spurt area. They're not overlapping in terms of their location, but geographically they're both around Mount Spurt. These were awarded actually just after our last hearing over the summer. They were effective, I believe, September 1st. And so they are now currently in their 2-year prospecting permit stage. Should this bill be moved through and approved, then these two existing permittees would benefit from the ability to extend from a 2-year to a 5-year. So these are parties that would be affected now. We do also currently have an application in place for an Augustine Island. That one is currently under review, and our preliminary best interest finding on that should be coming out in the coming months. We'll just pause if there's any questions related to our leasing history or current permit.
Not seeing any in person. Representative Fields, you can interrupt anytime you have a question during the end of a slide. I think we can move on, Ms. Payne.
Okay, thank you. So for our next slide, we are looking at slide 6. This is our sectional summary in which we are kind of highlighting everything that we are seeking to adopt and change in this bill. The following slides will go into this in more detail. As you can see, there will be some updating of language, changing of the word permit to license. We will be seeking to explicitly state that this is not intended to apply to small scale or home use. Again, to the questions that were raised earlier by Representative Hannon, that is already implicit in the current statutes, but we'd like to, while we're making these updates, just explicitly state it for clarity for all, for perpetuity. Again, there's looking to modernize our definitions and to increase some of those timelines and acreage positions that we've discussed and that I will review here in more detail as we get through the analysis. So moving on to our next slide. Move us down to slide 8, which is going to be section 2, the private use exemption that we have discussed. So the specific language that is going to be added is that a prospective licensee or lease is not required under this section to explore for, develop, or use geothermal resources if the geothermal resource is intended for domestic, non-commercial, or small-scale industrial use. Again, we're really seeking to ensure that we can provide the private landowners with the certainty in statute that their ability to access the geothermal that may be used for something like a grout source heat pump is protected in law.
Thank you, Ms. Payne. Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm just curious, we talk about the exclusion for domestic, non-commercial, and small-scale industrial use. And then talk about heat pumps. What's the largest, project that someone could put in place under this domestic, non-commercial, or small-scale industrial use? Or where would I find the definitions for that?
Representative Shragi, for the chair. So thank you for that question. So we've intentionally not limited it to a specific size, so that it can be taken into account based on the use. So for instance, we don't want to set a cap at something and say it's, you know, however many kilowatts, because as we found by the caps that were provided in terms of our definition of geothermal and temperature, that in the future, or under different technology standards or uses, we may have restricted folks unnecessarily. And so when we are thinking about this, we're really focused on some resource that's going to be produced and then sold, distributed to multiple clients. And so that's why we didn't really set a specific kilowatt or megawatt exemption on there.
Follow-up, if I may?
Follow-up.
So, I mean, is there any risk that someone that's using this for a non-commercial use or someone that develops geothermal infrastructure for non-commercial use could end up impacting other uses unintentionally? Or is there any chance that that would cause issues for the state?
A representative through the chair. So as a follow-up to that, despite the type of project that would go in, if someone is materially using of state land or creating a large sort of project, that project may not require a specific geothermal prospecting permit, but it would no doubt require other sorts of permits and authorizations that may come out of DNR or DEC or any other agency. And so we do have public processes in place that through those other permits that may be required would then be able to vet that sort of risk out.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions on this slide. I think we can move forward.
Okay, thank you. So now we've turned to slide 9. And so this is on preferential rights. And so one of the provisions of this bill is to remove the preferential rights clause out of the existing language. And if I may, I'm just going to pause for a moment and bring up that language. My apologies, I don't have it on that slide here, but it's certainly something we can send to the committee again later. The preferential rights clause, what it does now is it allows that a surface owner may exercise the preferential rights within 30 days after receiving notice of the application for a permit or by agreeing to meet the terms of a bid within 60 days after receiving notice of the acceptance of the bid for a lease. So essentially, under the current statute, if someone were to come in and apply for a prospecting permit, through our public notice process, we would make that known. And the surface owner could then come in and put a permit over the top of that one and say, I would like to use that. Now, here's where this gets to our point about the explicit exemption. We want to make sure that anything that is in this non-commercial realm that is small scale would not be impacted. So these type of projects would only be of the size and magnitude that an individual would not most likely be able to fund and continue on with the exploration of a large-scale program. This is just to provide the certainty so that someone who has gone through, spent money on surveys, and done the work to inspect and seek to come in to explore for geothermal doesn't have to run the risk of someone essentially placing a permit application on top of them and then thereby selling that permit right back to them at a fee. I know that sounds a little bit circuitous, but that is essentially what the removal of the preferential rights clause was seeking to prevent. And it is also another reason that we wanted to explicitly state that this does not apply so that surface landowners are not concerned that their domestic use would in any way be infringed upon this. To take this further, we do have several different provisions and processes in place in which the surface owner rights are protected, specifically statute AS 3805-130. If there's ever a concern between a surface owner and someone entering their property in order to explore for a mineral resource that has been granted through geothermal or oil and gas or other sort of lease, the DNR will intervene and ensure that that landowner is not harmed financially and do an evaluation to make sure everything is bonded sufficiently. So There is a process, a public process in place in which we move forward under this. It involves a hearing. It involves the commissioner doing an evaluation and ensuring that those funds are there. And so while this situation is highly, highly unlikely, there are processes in place in order to provide protection to any surface landowners. And as always, there is a robust public notice process as a part of our lease license issuance. This, of course, was a section where we had lots of questions before, and so I just wanted to make sure and re-highlight some of those issues that were brought up in the past.
Thank you, Ms. Payne. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Payne, thank you for going over that, and we certainly did have some questions last time. I remember that now. And looking at these 2 points under 3805.130, it says that no private landowner would be left without heat or power, but the scenario is unlikely because private landowners usually don't have financial resources to develop a commercially viable geothermal resource. So if a individual has a heat pump on their property that they've developed themselves just for their own private use, their home, their farm, whatever it is, something that would not rise to the scale of this bill, but then, obviously, oh, look, that has a good geothermal potential. Somebody comes in, surrounds them, takes a 100,000-acre lease, and develops the resource underneath them that somehow drains the geothermal potential for that home in that private facility. Would this protect that homeowner in that situation where they would lose access to that geothermal resource because of the commercial development of a larger one?
Representative Hopkins to the chair. So again, while that scenario may be highly unlikely, we do believe these provisions would absolutely protect that landowner. And as Director Masterman can interject, I do believe that the sort of resource that is used to power a home heat pump may not actually be connected to something on the scale that would be large enough in order to warrant some sort of commercial development. But I'll let him speak to the likelihood or the implications of those sorts of interactions at the subsurface level.
Yes, again, this is Steve Masterman, Director of DDGS, and through the Chair, Representative Hopkins. I think that we're talking a kind of a scale issue here and a depth issue here. For a home heat pump type of system, you're looking at very shallow depths, generally speaking, in the tens of feet. Whereas when you're looking at commercial scale and commercial temperatures for geothermal systems, you're typically talking at depth ranges of 1,000 or greater than 1,000 feet. So the depth separation between these two systems is going to be substantial and very likely tapping into different sources of either fluids or heat. And so I think, you know, geologically and thermally, they're going to be very distinct. And as Ms. Payne noted, it's a very unlikely scenario as well. So hopefully that answers your question. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Masterman. Quick follow-up on a different point. Ms. Payne, you had talked about the robust public notice process for this. Are the private landowners who are impacted by a lease submission, are they noticed or is it posted? Are they mailed a notice saying, hey, something's happening, just FYI, look at, you know, this website, or is it just posted on a state website or in a public domain that they would have to go check on themselves?
Representative Hopkins of the chair. So as a part of our disposal process, which this permit is engaged with, it is more of a posting. So that is going to be the first step. The general disposal is done by posting. By statute, we do things through the newspaper, through our website, et cetera. But when we move into specific sorts of operations, there is a more specified notification process. In order to receive a plan of operations through the Division of Oil and Gas, we do require that you identify the surface landowners that may be impacted by this. So at the scale that this bill is talking about, which is at the permit, it is at the disposal phase. It is more of a general posting. But as we actually had a known project and a known plan, then it becomes more specific.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hopkins. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Payne, the preferential rights, your top bullet here, would no longer automatically give you a preferential right over water rights in House Bill 135, but later on in your presentation, you talk about hydrothermal systems are the most common form of energy extraction from the geothermal heat. So I am wondering what the expectation is for the water use permits that I assume would still at some point need to be done. So once you've discovered a geothermal findings that you think is substantial enough for commercial development, where do the water rights and that permitting come in? I appreciate it not being preferential, but it seems to me it's still going to need to be addressed. I think many of us, our awareness of geothermal comes from hot springs, et cetera, water systems, and then seeing that the technology does use the term of hydrothermal systems being the most common way to develop geothermal. So tell me about the water rights and where that will intersect in this process.
Representative Hannon through the chair, and so the water rights would be a part of the separate the separate permitting process that would have to take place as regarding to DEC. And so that would have to be something, unless one of the other folks on the line has specific information, that we would need to follow up with you about in terms of more detail to more specifically answer.
Mr. Masterman, or... excuse me, Ms. Payne, were you handing that off to somebody else on the team, and if so, can they?
I do not have a specific a folk on the line that I thought might have the answer, but from my understanding, that's something that we would have to do provide some more specific information on, as that public process is actually as water rights are run through our Department of Environmental Conservation, and so they would be the best person to answer that. And so I'd be happy to get some more information together in terms of what water rights applications look like.
Okay, we'll look for a follow-up on that. Mr. Masterman, go ahead, or Mr. Clifton.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Steve Masterman. And I'm not an expert on water rights, so I'm not going to address that. But I think just to add a little color to the conversation, most people, when they obtain water rights, are doing so either for agricultural or for domestic use. And so they're typically wanting fairly high quality water that is not going to be full of minerals or full of chemicals or dissolved constituents. And so when we think of geothermal systems, they're often very brine rich, in other words, rich in salt or rich in sulfur, and may have chemical attributes that make them unsuitable for drinking or agricultural use. And so while, again, you know, there is potential for overlap of water rights or competitive uses, I guess, or competitive needs for water, the chemical attributes of the water in question that we're dealing with for geothermal use and for agricultural or domestic use, I think, are quite distinct. And so I just wanted to offer those comments to help flavor the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Masterman. Follow-up, Representative Hannah.
So my follow-up, and Mr. Chairman, I think it is for you as much as it is for DNR, is I would like to hear formally from DEC on this, because it may not be within DNR's purview, but in many parts of Alaska, the water use rights and preferential water use rights about salmon spawning streams are frequently close to where you may see some geothermal evidence, and I'm thinking specifically the Bristol Bay area where there's some hot pots known of. And I want to just make sure that we are not creating a water conflict. You know, we are not a state that has the water rights wars that many of our Western neighbors do. And I don't want to create one by siloing geothermal from water rights when we know they are integrated.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. My office will work with Ms. Boomershine to make sure we can schedule up during next week. I'm not sure if they'll be able to make the turnaround to present to us on Monday, but definitely before we move the bill out, we should have a follow-up from DEC as to where the permitting process, where in the permitting process water rights are interjected. So we'll be sure to gather some information and schedule it on the next meeting. Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you through the chair. So I think my questions are along a similar line, which is just some concern over competing interests. And, you know, while I understand most of the water rights issues are currently over non-brine rich waters, as we explore geothermal more, I do have some concern that if an industrial project were to go in, that that could impact the heat potential of other private users, non-commercial users. And just kind of curious, I think this would be more once they get into the point of actually putting in those developments, but do they have to do an assessment on other users currently with heat pumps and whether, do we track whether or not there's a loss of efficiency or a loss of heat potential due to some other development? So if you're able to address that now, that'd be great. Otherwise, we can follow up with that along the along with the other water rights issues down the line.
Representative the chair, what I would just add to that is that, you know, as brought up before in terms of surface owner rights and protections, we do have the process in place in order to identify whether or not anyone's heat or power or other beneficial uses of their property would be impacted. And so we would be able to evaluate, intervene, and make sure compensation is in place in order to do so. But again, I think Director Masterman's point before in terms of the differences in locations and depth, but he may be able to speak to the potential competitions that could arise.
Mr. Chair, this is Sean Clifton. Could I say something about this?
Go ahead, Mr. Clifton.
All right. For the record, this is Sean Clifton, Policy and Program Specialist for the Division of Oil and Gas. I just wanted to clarify what's said on that slide with respect to water rights. It's not saying that this has anything to do with water rights, because it doesn't. It's saying that the concept is similar or more relevant to water rights. And I don't think that any of these cases that we've been discussing here actually have anything to do with water rights. Water rights is actually managed by the water section in the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. And so people who are seeking to secure water rights or have a water rights dispute handled would do that through the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. But also, as Director Masterman pointed out, the typical water rights issues are with clean water that you could drink or water your crop with, not the type of fluids that might be used for geothermal resources. And as for Representative Hannon's comment, she is correct that DEC does handle issues where contamination of surface water might be an issue. They absolutely do. And that would of course, be looked at, and permits would have to be applied for in the case of a development scenario where they're actually in the process of planning for a power plant development. So I hope that clarifies some of the things that have been brought up.
Thank you, Mr. Clifton. I think we'll still look for a little more in-depth understanding of the different types of water rights in regards to how it can be affected by HB 135. Are there any other questions on preferential rights slide before we move on? Seeing or hearing none.
Thank you, Chairman. So we're moving on now to slide 10, which looks at the work commitment. So again, we're going to be changing terminology from a prospecting permit to a license, and also increasing the duration of time from 2 years to 5 years. We believe this provides greater opportunity for success for this non-competitive program. Just to provide some context on that, a lease is granted for 10 years. And so often, as we are aware, with the robust permitting and public notice processes that go in place in order for access of land, having a two-year window, we believe, can sometimes take the whole permitting if necessary. And so we would like to go from 2 years to 5 years on this. The other main component of this is going to be the conversion to a non-competitive lease through the completion of agreed-upon work commitment. This harkens back to our oil and gas exploration license program, in which this is how the conversion process is done. The bar to prove a commercial resource is quite a high bar, and it can take a significant amount of time, even in oil and gas or geothermal. And so we think that a party who has gone through and been able to complete a specified work commitment that has been outlined and approved by the director and through a public process is a more robust and a more consistent way of moving forward. So again, we're just seeking to align our geothermal program with our oil and gas program in terms of the requirements. And I'll pause if there's any questions on this slide before moving on to slide 11.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The you said that the changing the word from permit to license and expanding it from 2 years to 5 years gives a five-year extension, obviously, of the work commitment, but the lease for up to 100,000 acres is for 10 years?
Representative Hopkins to the chair. So in our, as a part of our leasing program, the competitive leasing program, they are issued for a primary term of 10 years. That is correct. Each lease itself would not necessarily be 100,000 acres. I believe we do have smaller parcel sizes when it comes to leases. And so an individual lease tract can be something closer to, let's say, I know I'm more familiar with oil and gas. We have 5,280 acres is a very common parcel size when we're talking more about leasing itself. But yes, sir, under our competitive geothermal program, which this bill does not impact, they are granted 10 years in which to explore the area. Because this is non-competitive, it is a slightly shorter duration of time because we always want to make sure and encourage as many folks as possible to get out there and compete to explore our resources.
Follow-up. Thank you. So just make sure I got this correct. They can lease for 10 years of whatever size, up to 100,000, but they can lease for 10 years, and the work commitment is for 5 years. And assuming at that point you have, so let's say you have not completed your work commitment of 5 years, do you still have that lease for another 5 years that you were working on?
And Representative Hopkins to the chair, so our competitive leasing program does not include a work commitment provision. Essentially, in order to maintain a lease beyond the 10 years, then you have to either move to unitization or it has to achieve production. So this work commitment component is separate and unique and specific to what we're kind of calling an exploration license program. And so the five-year work commitment aligns with the five-year term of the exploration license itself. And so if you have not been able to, in the case of our exploration license, successfully complete your work commitment, I believe that there's provisions that where you can apply for an extension of time to complete your work commitment. That would go through the commissioner director's office, and there could be some further requirements in terms of performance guarantees along with that.
Does that
answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none.
Okay, thank you. So we are now on slide 11, which is looking at geothermal fluids. And for this slide and the next slide, I will turn it over to Director Masterman.
Yes, thank you again for the record. This is Steve Masterman, Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. So one of the things that we're looking to do with this bill is to update the definitions for a geothermal fluid and a geothermal resource. And this slide deals with the definition for a geothermal fluid, and in it you can see things that we have added in bold and deleted with a strike through symbol there through the text. So this changes in this definition really modernize the definition for geothermal fluid. It clearly separates the hydrocarbon resources to make sure that they could not be considered a geothermal fluid. And also it allows for situations where an explorer might encounter hot and dry rocks and extract the heat by injecting a fluid into them and then recovering that fluid. So that would be the situation where you have an artificially present fluid in a geothermal system. So those changes modernize this definition. I guess the biggest one probably in here is the change that removes the temperature criteria for geothermal fluid. And that is because the technology for geothermal systems is advancing to allow exploitation of lower temperature systems. And as such, we wanted to not constrain the definition of geothermal fluid by having that temperature limit in there. Are there any questions on this change?
Seeing or hearing none, I don't think so.
Okay, let's move on to the next definition. And this is a new definition for a geothermal resource. And basically, this kind of comports with the prior definition of a geothermal fluid, where it does not have a temperature limitation on it. It also allows for artificial fluids being used to extract the heat. And it again, separates out quite clearly that hydrocarbon fluids, oil, and natural gas or other hydrocarbon fluids are not considered a geothermal resource. Are there any questions on this slide?
Doesn't look like there are any. Please move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And with that, we have concluded our presentation today. We do have backup slides available to answer any questions in terms of some of the geothermal background and technical information that we've provided to committee before. But with that, we'll pause and just see if there's anything that we can answer for you.
Okay, Representative Hopkins.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. I'm on a roll today. Might as well keep going. Director Masterman, you guys have a wonderful system called the Alaska Mapper that has a lot of mineral mapping and exploration opportunities for the public to go look at. Are geothermal potential on that Alaska Mapper at all? I have not been on there recently.
Through the chair, it's an excellent question. Perfectly honest, I don't know the answer to that, whether it's on the Alaska Mapper app or not. We do have a webpage on our DGGS website that does have locations of all the known thermal springs, and each of those is a live link to allow you to access the information that we have available pertaining to whichever spring it is. So there is a website out there on the state system that has geothermal information, but whether that layer is in the Alaska Mapa app or not, I will have to get back to you on that.
That's okay. I can go look on the Alaska Mapa and play around myself, but it's good to know that it is available out there on the on your website, as well as I'm sure AEA and ADA have plenty of ones too. So thank you for that.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm going to take Representative Hopkins' option, and since we have geologists and geothermal specialists online, and you know, about a week ago the Hunga Tonga Hunga Haiapai volcano erupted, and I'm just wondering whether you saw activity or what that, you know, I assume your conversations surrounding that were much more scientific based than those of us watching it from the press level, and anything or insights or interests that you have on that?
Through the chair, we live on a single rock, you know, it's one rock and it's all interconnected, just like the human body. And so when you ring the bell like that, anywhere around the planet, it will have repercussions elsewhere. We really haven't seen direct, follow-on eruptions of Alaska's volcanoes. But I had a conversation last week with the head of the Alaska Volcano Observatory and the director of the USGS Science Center in Anchorage about putting out a notice on, you know, what are the risks or the possibilities for an eruption of that kind in Alaska. And quite honestly, it's not that high. Our magma types are a little bit different. We do have some submarine volcanoes. We do have some emerging volcanoes. And those are the ones where they're close to the sea, surface of the sea, that you can have an eruption that causes the magma chamber to be breached and the seawater penetrate the magma chamber. And that's when you have these really explosive types of devastating eruptions like occurred there. The other one that's a well-known eruption was Krakatoa in the last century, and that was in Indonesia and destroyed the island. Massive tidal waves killed a lot of people, and they actually heard that explosion in Belgium. So, but for right now, I think we're okay. So,
thank you.
Thank you, and I'm sure that when we go over it later on, whether it's Monday or Wednesday, in regards to Representative Hannon's question, or if it'd be worth going over now, under your supplemental information, slide 31, it talks a little bit about the different roles that these different entities play in regards to drilling regulations. And maybe it is something we should just go over with the whole shebang of water rights at a later date, unless, Ms. Payne, you'd like to touch on that a little bit.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I think it may be best if we go ahead and get the whole group together to be able to more clearly answer and speak to any questions that folks may have specifically with regards to AOGCC or DEC.
Thank you. Any other questions regarding HB 135? Representative Shragi.
Yeah, just a question for the Chair. Given the interest in getting answers on some of the water rights issues, does that affect the timeline for this bill and the amendment deadline?
Yeah, we'll probably extend the amendment deadline out to Tuesday, assuming that we'd like to have a hearing on it on Monday, go through any initial amendments, and then based on new information with DEC on Monday, that we can extend to Tuesday for additional amendments, and then potentially move it out with the last of the amendments on Wednesday. So,
thanks for the clarification.
Yep, no worries. All right, well, with that, we'll take a brief at ease. There we are. Sorry to interrupt the discussion there. I was just clarifying a few things in regards to our public hearing or public testimony. Since we are extending another hearing potentially into next week, we will have public testimony today. So in regards to one, House Bill 135 will now reopen public testimony on it. And Leo, can you clarify if we have anybody called in for public testimony? Okay. With that, we'll close public testimony on House Bill 135. Ms. Boomershine, Ms. Payne, Mr. Masterman, and all of the others, Mr. Clifton, thank you for bringing the information back up for us in regards to 135. We're looking forward to working with you on it furthermore next week. And just to clarify again, our back and forth, Representative Shragi, we're extending the amendment deadline to Tuesday. With a first round of amendments and a DEC hearing potentially on Monday. And then I'd like to move the bill, if it's the flavor of the committee, on Wednesday after that amendment deadline. So welcome back, I guess. That's a good start, I would say. With that, this meeting is adjourned at 2:03 p.m.